Hello and welcome back to the Millennial Ag Podcast, where agriculture is always on tap and no topic is off limits. Thanks for joining us today, your co-hosts, Valene Cawhorn and Catherine Lotsbeach.
Welcome back, listeners, to this week's episode. We're going to have a fun series at the Idaho Cattle Association Convention. So bring to you different aspects of the Idaho cattle industry. And first off, we've got Lynn Bachman and Jared Brackett here with us with the Idaho Beef Council. So I'm going to let them introduce themselves, but super excited to have you both here. And thank you for joining us.
So I'm Lynn Bachman, fifth generation farmer rancher. I know Idaho, which is kind of southwestern part of the state. I represent the cow-calf sector on the Idaho Beef Council.
Very cool. Jared?
So Jared Brackett, fifth generation rancher from southern Idaho, just south of Bruno a little ways. We've got a small cow-calf operation, and then we got a backgrounding operation where we background cattle for Catcher Natural Beef. And then we also, which is a co-op, and then we also are part owners in True West. So we finish everything we raise, and we also buy cattle. And then I have a small locker beef business that we market direct to consumer, and I'm currently in my first year on the Idaho Beef Council.
Very cool. Well, thank you guys for both joining us today. Maybe just paint the picture of where the industry is today and then how consumer demand is. We've talked a lot today about what consumers are buying at the grocery store, but let's start by painting a picture of where the beef industry is, cattle numbers, price in the grocery store, that sort of thing, and what we're seeing as far as consumers' preference for beef.
So I think today's beef industry is, I would say, probably in record levels we haven't ever seen before. Our numbers are incredibly tight on the supply side, which causes our production to be less. And so there's record amount of people consuming beef, causing the price to be record levels. The best part is the demand is still record high. And so the consumers are still finding value in our product. I think it's great that we're able to take advantage of these opportunities. And it's been a long time. The cow-calf industry went through some periods of pain and suffering where we didn't make a lot of money. And now that's finally coming back. We're actually able to put some money back in our pockets and keep our producers happy, as well as provide nutritious product for the tool.
So in Idaho, nationally, the cattle numbers are low, which has increased the price. In Idaho, we've got a unique situation in the last 5 years has kind of brought cattle back into the state. So our numbers are fairly stable, partly due to the dairies and a unique beef on dairy crossbreed that has kind of helped stabilize the market here locally in Idaho. But it's really changed and is still changing the industry statewide.
And we're also, I would say, probably seeing we have more packing capacity in the state of Idaho than we have historically to the West and those mid-sized packers coming online too.
Is that I have two brand new packers in 5 years. And one of them, we're part owners, and the other one is in Eastern Idaho, which is a more of a direct consumer. But it's amazing to see that, you know, we became an importer of cattle in the state of Idaho, importer of feeder cattle, fat cattle, where we used to export a lot of cattle outside the state to finish elsewhere. And that's providing high quality jobs, but also a local option for people when they go to get their food from a grocery store. It's really neat to see, you know, the Winco that has CS beef, or go Swinson's that has True West beef, or Albertson's that has Double R beef, and to know that that's our product from our producers locally being produced. It's really rewarding to see that. Yeah, I think that's a really cool thing. That's going to continue as those plants continue to grow and get there.
Well, and one of the panels we saw today was four female consumers in the state of Idaho who were educated and local residents, but it seemed like all of them valued that local product, that they can say, oh, I know where that came from, or I feel better about supporting local as well, which was good to hear with our capacity. Are you seeing that, you know, with all the research and data that the Beef Council's pulling in as well?
Definitely. We have the best story any ag group out there with our product and how it's produced. Something that came about, and you can blame COVID for a lot of things, but one good thing that came out of COVID is people want local. When your local stores, when they run out of product, it's because of the supply capacity, the shipping lanes. They want local. And so local product for demands a premium now. And people are more aware of where food comes from too. And the technology is so much easier for this where it comes from. And that's why the local is such a big deal. Local homegrown farmers markets are exploding. You have all this stuff that's good. It's that's part of that is also driven by demand, which the checkoff, we really focus on getting consumers educated. And so that they're more involved. They understand what's where that product's coming from, but also that we have a very safe, trusted beef system.
The Beef Council itself is essentially an education organization. And
we're local people. That's the thing about Beef Councils. Your Idaho Beef Council is made up of Idaho producers. And when you get on the national level, the national checkoff, the Federation is made up of local producers that go to national meetings. The Cattlemen's Beef Board, which is the national side of the checkoff, is made up of local producers from the states, nominated by state agencies. These are local people making decisions on our producers' behalf to help continue to drive our demand for beef to make it better, but also educate consumers so that they trust their beef supply. And I think you've done a really good job. The numbers show that. It was a little bit disappointing to me in the panel that we didn't have more knowledge. I think if we would ask the right questions, I think we could have got that out of them. Like if you would ask him, do you recognize beef? It's what's for dinner. I would almost think that at least three of the four would have said yes. The dietitian, she talked about the fact that there was beef helped send people to their clinics and their conventions to explain how beef plays a healthy role in their deal. It was just fascinating to me on the panel that of the three protein sources, you had chicken, beef, which definitely obviously one and two, but eggs were three. And I would have thought that pork or fish would have been three for some of those people. So that part was interesting. We always have a way to go with our consumers. The work's never done. But I also think we've done a good job in educating, promoting, and maintaining that top of mind center of plate when people go out to eat and when they're buying product.
What were your thoughts then on the panel discussion?
I kind of came in a little bit late. I missed the first half of it. It was interesting to see and hear how much those ladies didn't know. Shows that we still have some work to do with our funds, but they still buy beef.
My question is, so they're buying beef. It's one of their top options. I mean, and a price point, like chicken's still cheaper than beef a lot of times when they're feeding their families, and they said price was thing. Are they wanting more information, or are they happy to know that beef is good and we'll continue to buy it? So like, Do they want that information, and are they seeking that information out?
I think it depends on the consumer individually. You know, some people want to know more. Some people get a little more concerned when there's a news story and then go, you know, what their trigger might be to actually engage. So you can't just reach somebody. We have found that out. And, you know, I'm a rancher. I'm not a marketer. So I've learned a lot by being on the Beef Council. If the consumer's not ready to hear, they're not going to hear it no matter what you do. So maybe they're happy with the way they feel about the beef as it is. So they're not looking.
One thing that we found, at least in some of the past studies and stuff we've been involved with on checkoff work from some of our contractors, is some of the best marketing campaigns are when people don't know they're directly being marketed to. And there's a lot of people that don't like being marketed to. So there's that little bit of subliminal. So it's in the back of their mind. They hear about it. They get stored away. They don't think about it until later. And I think that might be a little bit what we saw on that panel today. Like if you ask them in the grocery store about quality grain, I guarantee you that they would have been able to say, yes, I want prime or choice over select. But you ask them about quality grade without that image in front of them, I think that's why they didn't understand the quality grade part. And I just find that stuff interesting that as we move forward with our marketing and are trying to get these consumers to buy more beef, and not simply buy more beef, but maybe continue buying beef is a better way to put it, mm-hmm. especially in today's price challenge, to have them have that comfort level with it, that we know this product, it's been good, and to continue to have that, I think is probably as important as trying to get somebody to try new. So,
and the little bit of a language barrier, right? It's just like when you start in a new career and they talk about somebody, like they may know what choice and prime are, but they might not know that it's called quality grade.
Correct.
You know, and so I think there might have been some confusion in that, because the one lady wanted, she recognized Wagyu and knew that that was a premium product, but didn't care about quality grade. Like, it was fascinating to some of those contradictory answers to very similar questions. Or one lady's wanted lean beef, but quality grade was a high thing. And, you know, a choice, it has less marbling than prime. But it was just interesting to see some of the contradictions with some of their answers across the board.
But I think that's what we see in consumers in general. I think by and large, unfortunately, they are very uneducated. And that's one of the hurdles we have to try to get across. And the best part about today's technology is, you know, we have the ability to do QR codes and things that, like, especially the younger generations that always have a cell phone in their hands now, that, you know, they go to the grocery store and they look and they can say, I want to look up and see what this product is. And let's say it's a pot roast, right? Well, if there's a specific way to cook that pot roast, they can look it up and figure it out, versus they don't even touch it because they don't want to try it, right? And that, so that's, I think, some opportunities that we have, that as this next generation starts becoming the parents and the providers, and they're doing more of this, they're going to continue to eat out more than they ever have before. But when people are purchasing something, they're going to be more creative and looking for stuff. Where maybe some of us in the past, as older people, now that I'm an older person, you know, I'm finally 50, so I wouldn't even consider that anymore. I mean, like, no, I'm okay. I've kind of set my ways a little bit. So I think there's a real opportunity there. And I see, you're going to see more marketing campaigns go that route. It's fascinating to see that stuff.
Well, maybe that leads into some of our import-export conversations, you know, getting excited to try new things. But are we to the point of wanting to try tongues, livers, oxtails in the grocery store? Or is that still a prime for our export markets?
The export market's interesting because we're talking about tongues and livers as, oh, let's maybe try it. And there's places in other countries in the world where they look at that as a premium product, that they prefer that over a rib steak. And for us as producers, you know, there's a lot of pieces to a cow, which gives it a whole lot of different price points. So one day you can have ground beef for $4 a pound, and then you can have a steak that's 12 or 16. But there's also these parts that, yeah, I'll try it once in a while. I might have liver and onions twice a year. We can export those products at a premium to other countries and help add value to that carcass back to the producers all the way through the value chain.
Yeah, and that's the best part about the export market is some people get misconceptions about exports. We're not exporting, by and large, ribeyes and T-bones. We're exporting liver, tripe, tongue, short plate, things that we really don't eat a lot of here in the States, but they consider it a delicacy when you go to Japan or Korea or Mexico or even Peru or Egypt. And that's where the U.S. Export Market Federation comes in, and they're adding over $400 to the carcass value that goes back to us producers. That's huge. I mean, A, we can't eat all the beef we produce here. So if we weren't exporting that, that would be subtracted from the carcass value. Our price definitely wouldn't be near as good. And because we'd have oversupply, we wouldn't have near as good a price in the grocery store either. And then there's a flip side to the export. There's going to be some imports that go with that, right? What do we do a really good job in the United States producing? Big fat carcasses. What's on that big fat carcasses? Lots of high quality fat. What do we need to do that? We take good quality lean trim from other countries and we grind that, turn it into hamburgers that get served all over the States. And it's a good product. And it saves us a lot of money and makes it so we don't have to grind rounds. We don't have to grind chunks. These are things that we can export. We get better value. So if you're looking at the total picture, the value of product that we export versus the value of product we import, we're dollars ahead. It's good for our industry. So we really appreciate the exports.
The latest just cattle market I saw, the margins on the packers right now are negative, you know? And so if you take out the $400 a head you just talked about, they're losing 50% of an animal at that point if we don't have that market. So it's very important to maintain that for all segments of the industry, but packers would be in a world of hurt without it, right?
Well, everything flows downhill, right? And right now, and supply and demand controls everything we do. And right now, we've got a really short supply and we've got great demand. If you take 10% of our demand away that goes overseas, and all of a sudden that has to stay here, our price is going to go down. And the flip side, because we're not exporting all that stuff overseas, the tongue, the tripe, the liver, all this other stuff, then we don't get the extra value for it, which makes the packers even less profitable. And let's be honest, it's painful. We need that segment of our industry because that's the segment that helps harvest those cattle and put them in boxes and takes them to the butchers so that we can actually get it out to the consumer. So they're a very important part of our industry, even though some people might dislike it. They're very important to us. So I think we need to remember that, you know, they're a necessary evil to a certain point.
The export portion of the beef industry is a sustainability story, one of them. Every piece of that animal is used some way, whether it's here or we can market it somewhere else. So otherwise it would be landfill or pet food.
I think that's a great point. We are utilizing the entire carcass for the best use possible. Yep. And in order to do that, we have to build the export. But we also have to build the import too. Make that work. And so it is a sustainable issue. We're not exporting full carcasses. We're not importing full carcasses. We're importing stuff that we need. We're exporting things we can't use. And so it's kind of better or worse horse trading a little bit, right?
Yeah.
But it works really well and it provides the highest value for everything. So it's really important to continue to do that.
And you're efficient on packaging, right? Because if you can put a bunch of livers in one box and ship it to Egypt or wherever, it's a lot more efficient than putting a full-sized carcass with T-bones and hamburger and with a bunch of dead space in there too.
Yeah, exactly.
And bone.
Well, and then certain places, you know, restrictions. And the other thing people don't realize in import and exports is most of the rules that we put on other places for that we live with on that, if we export to them, we have to accept those rules for ourselves. And so then when people come to me and say, we shouldn't be importing anything, and it's like that. We need to be able to export. And so in order to export, we have to import. So as long as we're on the better side of that dollar value trade, it's a no-brainer to me. And then you brought on the point of the sustainability thing. To me, that sums it up even better. That's being savvy, but also responsible with what we're doing with that.
And as the Idaho Beef Council, we seem to be visiting quite a bit here about exports. We have more cows in the state than we do people. So exports to us, even full carcasses or high value cuts, say your ribs, your loins and those things. And as a state, we export the majority of it to where the populations are. So we look at exports as across state lines, nationally, and then also internationally.
Yeah, I think that's a great point because cows live where people don't, and you don't want cows in the middle of San Francisco. Like, it just is a recipe for disaster. And so, yeah, making it so that we can get San Francisco good, high quality Idaho beef is...
You could make the argument that San Francisco might be cleaner if cows lived there.
That is a very good point.
I've been to a lot of feedlots that are cleaner than San Francisco, so... Yeah, maybe we need to look into that. That might be some ways. Let's cycle San Francisco. But no, you're right. I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, when we talk about exports, it's not just national. It's statewide too. I mean, we're exported, you know, so it's really rewarding when you go places and you see that, you know, those local brands in those places. Like, you know, you go on a cruise ship and you see Double R product on their menu. It's really cool to see that kind of stuff. So to know we have an international and national presence with our local companies is really nice.
Yeah, no, for sure. Well, I can't thank you guys enough for taking a few minutes out of your evening and cutting into your beer drinking time. But where can people find more information about the Idaho Beef Council and the National Checkoff as well?
So they can go to ibc.com for the Idaho Beef Council, drivingdemandforbeef.com, or beefiswhatsfordinner.com. And all those will take you. You can go to the links. Do a little research. You can find websites. You can find recipes, studies, financial data. You know, if you're curious where we're spending our money, how we're spending our money, especially if you're a producer. And then it'll also give you the opportunity to if you want to get involved, and I'm a big proponent, get involved, because these decisions are made by local people. And right or wrong, we've got a lot of local people sometimes.
They're made by the guys that show up to the meetings.
Yeah.
If you don't like the decisions that come out of them, show up and voice your opinion, because it does matter.
Yep.
And we need everybody's voice at the table, because we all have different opinions and different experiences.
Yeah. So like our board's made up of 8. We've got 2 dairy producers. We've got 2 cow-calf producers, 2 feedlot representatives, and then a cattle lemons representative. So it's a broad spectrum of the industry here in the state.
Perfect. Well, again, thank you guys for your time on the Beef Council, and thank you for jumping on the podcast. All right. Our next guest is Cody Hendricks from Idaho Falls, and we're super excited to have Cody here. He's a banker, and so we're going to talk numbers and kind of where the industry is. So get us started, Cody. Give us a little background about yourself and your previous involvement in the Idaho Cattle Association.
Yeah, so like you said, I live up in East Idaho. Been working with Northwest Farm Credit, which is now AgWest Farm Credit, for 16 years. Been involved in Idaho Cattle Association for a lot of that time. I was on the board for 7 years. Came off last fall at convention, yeah. So background with hang cattle operation out of Nevada, actually. One of those desert guys, I guess. And just even with my, lending career, trying to stay involved with the cattle industry. So,
very cool. Well, maybe to get us started, you want to paint us a picture financially of where the beef cattle side of things are at today, because it's good and bad, depending on which sector of the industry you're in right now.
That is so majority of the producers I work with are obviously in the cow-calf sector, right, out in East Idaho and Central Mountains. Life's been pretty good for them, right? For a couple of years, they're making some money, and some of them think there is no top to the market. I'm a little more conservative. I'm saying we might be at the top, right? But, everyone I talk to just loving life right now. Great thing about the finance industry is really the real data is hindsight, right? So you look at 24, there were some stalkers and feeders that didn't make money. Most still did okay, right? Not like the cow-calf guys. And still just how they mark and everything is going to determine whether those guys stay profitable this year, I think, too. So did you want to know other commodities also?
Well, yeah, maybe we can say ag, but what I guess maybe even corn prices, hay prices, that sort of thing, because a lot of the guys have both, or they're feeding hay to their cattle, or the feeders are feeding.
You know, the hay thing's interesting to me. We've heard rumor of a lot of acres coming out in East Idaho this year because of rodent damage. I haven't actually talked to any of the farmers that pulled the acres out. Everyone just says, oh, so-and-so or my neighbor, you know, and you're talking thousands of acres, but I haven't actually talked to any of those guys. So I'm hoping it happened. Haven't been able to confirm it. You know, it seems like prices kind of crept up for the hay guys a little bit this spring, but I don't think anybody really seems to have a feel for where the market is. The exporters, I think, are out looking for some hay, but nobody's too aggressive or too active with it right now, which could bode well for cow guys again this year, right? They've been able to get some cheap hay. There's still a little bit left over, but I don't think we have as much left over from last year as what we thought we were going to have. I guess I don't know if you guys see that down here in the Magic Valley also. I've heard dairies have a lot sitting around, like they bought everything they needed, really, right? So,
and then I heard a rumor that Utah was needing hay. So it'll be interesting to see if, you know, they come to Idaho looking for their hay.
Yeah, we could use it from a hay perspective, not from a cattle perspective. So, but yeah.
Well, and so now we got cheap commodities, high beef prices. And maybe not your crystal ball, but what's historical data shown on the cyclical nature of where we're at? You know, because the guys were saying there's no ceiling. Is there a ceiling? Do we have a point when we're going to start rebuilding the herd? Are you guys seeing any market signals?
I mean, there's always a ceiling, right? What it comes down to is when the consumers quit buying, and that's our ceiling. As a consumer, I wouldn't want to pay anymore. I'm already paying enough for everything else, right? I don't know what that number is. As far as the cycle on the commodities, you know, we've been down a couple years, a year and a half, 2 years, whatever, on corn, wheat, hay prices, everything. You know, some of the industries that we work with in farm credit, we are seeing the bottom now. with prices starting to climb, the tree nuts and things like that. And so I think the hope is that the row crops are going to start following that in the next 12 months and start picking back up sour corn and hopefully. But
what's the current administration's impact on what's going? The uncertainty, we've been very honest about that on the podcast, but like how the threats of tariffs, the retracted tariffs, the labor, like everything's so volatile. Are you seeing that, you know, as a reflection just on a day-to-day basis on decision-making or people, right? Like, we just got to keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah, most of the producers that I talk to across all the ag sectors, you know, everyone I talk to feels like it's long-term, it's a good move, painful right now. And so they're all toughing through it right now. I don't have any producers that are really complaining about it per se, right? On the financial side, you know, every time Trump has done something, we've seen a lot of volatility in the financial markets, right? And so on the banking side, that has some effect. But it almost feels like, you know, you look back to October and it's like Trump blew his nose and the market's going to go up or down based on it, right? But it does feel like the financial markets are starting to get past that, I don't know, shock effect that Trump has. You know, he can say or spout off something and we don't have quite the reaction that we were. So I think that's a good thing for the economy. So,
and I think the media is getting a little less reactionary too. I think, I mean, the first 30, 60 days, he was very active on, but the media also responded very dramatically too, causing a lot more of the uncertainty. Yeah. So how much of it was Trump and how much of it was the media? And it was probably false.
Yeah. Because he likes to get a reaction out of people. Yeah. And then he can use the media as a megaphone, right?
Mm-hmm.
To get the reaction. So
where are you seeing interest rates?
You know, things have held steady for a while now. I say a while since fall. Our short-term rates have stayed pretty steady. Long-term rates came down a little bit through the end of the year and then picked back up. They've really just risen steady since February-ish. I don't know. Can't really predict it, right? But I think the Fed will probably do something this fall. But hard to say because, again, what's Trump going to throw on us in the next 3 months? What's that going to do to everything? I don't know.
Prices so, of something else might change in the process of it.
Yeah. But I think that's kind of what the financial markets have all been expecting is some movement in the fall. So it'd be nice to see more relief. I mean, everything's so expensive. Producers need any relief they get. Interest has become a huge part of the expenses for.
Well, and we were spoiled for a long time with 3% interest rates and mortgage rates, you know, in the 2%. And so what's like, there's got to be a happy medium too, because you can't stay with cheap interest rates or there's economic factors to that too, right?
Yeah. You know, I think we came up about 5%. It became hot and heavy, right? And we've come off about 1% since then. I think if we came off another 1%, I think we'd still be high enough. People got to make decisions before they spend money, but I think it'd be a lot more palatable for them to pay the interest. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be half a spot, maybe a little more than that, but better than free money, right?
Right. So for beginning ranchers or people interested in getting into the industry in some form or fashion from a lending standpoint, what's your recommendation? How does somebody come to you? Like, when do you accept a loan and when do you deny it? You know, what's smart move from your perspective?
I mean, it feels like a chicken and egg question, right? Like, you gotta get a little money so that you can start building something. You gotta build something so you're bankable. I spent a long time in my career working with our Ag Vision producers, which is our young and beginning producers, right? And I had a lot of folks that would come in, we'd look at financials together, and I'd tell them to go work with FSA for a couple of years because FSA doesn't need that equity yet, right? You know, if you've got a cash flow budget that looks like it's going to work, FSA can write you a loan to get through a year and try and make it work. And then when you get a couple of years like that under your belt, then you can try and jump over to a commercial lender and because you probably built a little equity. You know, there's a lot of volatility in the cattle industry. The margins are a lot tighter. But I think the barrier to entry is easier in the cattle industry, right? You don't have to have a land base. If you can find some pasture to rent, you can buy a few cows, you know what I mean? And I think it's a good way for people to start building some equity in an operation if they have knowledge and a passion for livestock, right? And then they can move into the farming side of it a lot easier if they don't have another mentor or generation ahead of them to get help from, you know what I mean?
Yep. And land prices don't seem to be backing off anytime soon either.
No, we thought we would see at least some leveling off, but there's not as much outside purchasing or a lot of folks from outside ag coming in buying ag ground as what we saw 2 or 3 years ago. But I think there is still some interest there because it's still a safe place to put some cash. It's more active in recreational properties still and larger tracts, but there is still interest. And then I think that local farmers feel like they still have to compete with those buyers. And so they're still offering full price, right? Even though commodities aren't able to cash flow that right now. So it's a challenge getting land. Yes.
And making, especially if you're young and need the land to live off of or pay the bills, like it takes some creative financials and some outside of the box thinking.
Yeah.
Can you get double crops? Can you graze it? Can you get something that's got some dry land attached to it rather than just pay full irrigated acres?
Yeah. Can you parcel off a couple corners and sell them for some residential, things like that? Yeah.
Cool. Well, Cody, thanks for joining us. Any words of wisdom you would like to leave listeners or the millennial generation or anything you've taken away from convention today?
Oh, am I putting on the spot? I should have played. Spend everything you earn. Save some. Because you're going to need some liquidity. So,
I think that's good advice, especially in today's era, too, where consumerism is at an all-time high. And I can buy any pair of shoes within 5 seconds of jumping on Amazon. So
that happens the next day.
Yes, exactly. So sometimes taking a time out from spending. So thanks again, Cody, for joining us.
Hi, I'm Tom Heron, founder of Ag Professionals. Agriculture is always innovating and evolving, and at Ag Professionals, we provide the expertise to help you stay ahead. From land use planning and environmental compliance, permitting to real estate, civil and environmental engineering and land surveying, we offer one-stop solutions you need to grow and succeed. We're proud to support the Millennial Ag Podcast because we believe in the future of agriculture. Let's build that future together. Visit our website, agpros.com, to learn how we can help your operation thrive.
Our next guest this week is Rex Hoagland, and he's on the Idaho Cattle Association Board of Directors, works at a packing plant, and owns some cows. So Rex, thanks so much for joining us.
Yep, you're welcome.
Do you want to give listeners a little background on who you are and what you've been up to?
So, been in the packing industry for 45, pushing 50 years, started back in 1980, and moved around the United States. So I've gotten to see a lot of different areas. And when I went in there, I went in open-minded and wanted to see how they done it, not how we done it out west before I moved there. So I've learned a lot from different parts of the United States and what they do and how they do it compared to us. Alabama, they run a cow-calf to about an acre and a half, and out west, we're anywhere from 20 to 50 acres per cow-calf. So huge differences, and a lot of that's all done by rainfall. But it has been a very enlightening experience to see all the parts of the country that I've seen, mainly the packing industry. But back when I first started, we did feed a lot of cattle with armor at a feedlot in Owyhee County. And I was very involved in the feedlot side of it too. And that was an interesting learn of how they fed cattle, finished them, and, you know, the numbers that you look at. And our business is strictly numbers, you know, either head counts or carcass weights or red meat yields or whatever it may be. We deal in a lot of numbers every day. So,
and understanding the product that you're getting to the packing plant and how it gets there probably helps paint the big picture for you of essentially plate to grass back in the beginning. So having that good swath of industry knowledge is really helpful.
Yeah. No, and start to finish, where that animal is going to fit in the plant once you're done with it.
Maybe for listeners, we've talked a lot about good cattle prices right now, but all-time low cattle numbers. Paint a picture of what the packing industry looks like right now with those record low cattle numbers.
So basically what's going on in the packing industry is that on the fat cattle side, they're trying to grow them bigger. So they move their carcass limits to 1,100. I think a lot of them would like to go bigger than that just to get the red meat out there to try and cover the shortage of red meat, if that makes sense. You make them bigger, you put on 24, 25, 30, 35 pounds per head, you make up for the shortage of numbers overall. So the plants are pushing, the fat cattle plants are pushing in weight-wise pretty close to full numbers, but they're running, you know, a third or a quarter less head count through that plant. So that's what they're trying to do to offset the expenses. And the fixed expenses go on every day. You have to, and so that up lowers and or makes your cost go up per head if you can't put the tonnage through there. So when I first started, we were probably looking at carcasses in the 750 range. And today, you know, we're averaging 950-ish. So we've upped that. That all started in the late 80s, early 90s. They wanted to get away from these low-line old-style cattle and get to the bigger ones, the exotic crosses, and that put a lot of red meat through the plant, and that was the name of the game.
Have the plants had to adapt, you know, to the heavier carcass weights, and what have they done, especially the old, you know, the older ones that are used to the smaller carcasses? What did they have to do to adapt to those big carcasses?
A lot of them had to raise their rails because their ceiling height wasn't high enough. They had plenty of ceiling up there. They just didn't lift the, you know, the rails at the time. When you're looking at a 750-pound carcass, you didn't need the height for it. And then once they started going bigger, then they started running into issues that they couldn't get them either on the viscery table correctly to, you know, to gut them, or those were their issues. They had to raise the rails. And if we continue with the carcass size, we're going to get a bigger framed animal that is going to be hanging a lot lower too. So they're going to have to readjust ceiling height again just to be able to handle them and make sure they can handle the weight, because that's a lot of weight on them rail rolling through a plant.
Do you think there's a ceiling in how big these carcasses will get to?
That's above my pay grade. But you know, the rumor on the street is they would like to go to 1,500-pound carcasses. That is a massive.
It'd be like 2,000.
It's a 2,300-pound animal at today's yield specs. So yeah, they're big.
And that's a more time in the feedlot too, probably, to get to. Or more efficient cattle, one of the two.
They're going to have to grow them bigger to go, before they go to the feedlot, because you can feed them forever, but you're just going to put more back fat on them. So you've got somewhere in the industry, if that comes to fruition, you know, we're going to have to figure out how to make that animal big enough going into the feedlot weighing, you know, 1,200 pounds that can go on to, well, it's going to be bigger than that, 1,500 pounds going in. But you're talking, that's the size of our dairy herd today on the Holstein side, is in that, you know, 1,450 to 1,525 kind of an average. Cattle, they may have to put a little more age on them to get to that size. I don't know exactly how it's going to get figured out, but there are brains out there that know how to do it. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah. No, and I mean, we've seen it in all industries of agriculture. In the animal proteins, the pigs, chickens are bigger. The dairy cows are producing more milk than they've ever produced. And
I think the problem there is that you've got to be careful, because you talk to a lot of people in the hog industry and they feel like they've bred the texture and the flavor somewhat out. So we don't want to do that to the beef, because we got the best quality beef in the world. And we're seeing that with our trade problems with our other countries. And, you know, they want to throw ringers at us about biosecurity and different stuff that makes no sense. We've got the safest product in the world. And I truly believe that the cattlemen and the dairymen in America, they want it that way. They do not want to go backwards. We want to sell our product to the world.
And we love what we do. So we want, and we want to keep feeding the world and sending product. And a lot of the product too that's going overseas is either, like, we've got high quality beef, but you've also got the tripe, the tongues, the livers that
the awful little America doesn't use.
Right. We might try it once a year if we want to get crazy, but most people don't even look at a tongue.
No. And livers, you know, people don't eat a lot of livers, but you got the Arab countries that love it. obviously they know how to cook it different than we do, but yeah, there's all different parts of the carcass that goes different directions, and we need those markets. Otherwise it just goes to rendering here and you make fertilizer out of it. So,
and that's not worth the same price as it is across the pond.
No, correct. Yeah, we're trying to maximize value.
What's the cold cow market looking like, or what? Because it seems like we've got less cows. So are the dairy industry and the beef industry still sending cold cows to market too? And what are those carcasses looking like?
Carcasses are actually looking good this year. The grass has been good. The cows are coming in, you know, with some good flesh on them. A little later in the fall when they come home with, you know, pulling that 500-pound calf off of them, they may be drawn down a little bit. But there's going to be plenty of feedlot room if these guys want to take 35, 40 days and throw them in the feedlot and put some weight gain back on them and maximize their returns. I think there's a good opportunity there this year and not cost them a lot of money. They can do the same on the bulls. The dairy industry is the dairy industry. Most of the dairies do not have what they call a dry lot pen to put them cows in and flush them up a little bit. They just pretty much go with it. But you've also got your cows that there's issues with them and they're just not gaining weight anyway. So they have to go. The biggest problem with putting them in the feedlot is now you start to deteriorate the lean point. So if you're trying to generate a lot of 90s, you don't get it because you're putting more fat on the end. And that's where the whole price structure comes from, is, you know, the lean points of the carcass and what you make of it. So for those who want 90% lean hamburger, it could get harder to get.
So that's an interesting point, because we're importing a lot of lean product too, to mix with our heavy fat cattle that have a lot more fat on them than they've ever had. And then we've got cold cows that are probably getting to the point of tasting better too than coming right off if we're finishing them. So is it better to keep them at the 90%, or is it, you know, get a little more weight and push them to 80% lean?
I think it's better to put the weight on them. You've got a better carcass. The thinner cows are harder on the plant all the way through because you've got very little meat to bone off of that carcass to make hamburger out of. If you can put a little bit of, you know, balloon that red meat up and do that correctly, you can balloon that red meat up and still have what we call a lean boning cow, and you're still going to generate an 85. But all of the imports that you talked about, there's reasons for the imports. Part of it is the lean point, but part of it's frozen too, because they take the frozen, the temperature to put with the fresh, and they blend that to where everything rolls through the system, making hamburger a lot smoother. There's a point of temperature there that needs to be hit for everything to run smooth. And you're not building grease up on your shafts and everything else, too fat a product going through there. But, you know, and then they're looking at price. You know, if they take a 90 and a 50 to get to a 75, you know, they got their blends of how much 50 and how much 90, or they go to an 85, 65. But they're looking at price points on how to blend that to get that hamburger price where they should. The one thing that I would like to talk about on the hamburger side, yesterday in the youth discussion we had, I had Miranda adding up the numbers. And when you take a pound of hamburger, $10, and you throw, I just threw out a hamburger helper box. And so you put the hamburger helper with it, can of corn and a roll. We came up with about just a little shy of $3 per head for a family of five to feed them. Yes, it takes 30 minutes of preparation to get it done and another 10 or 15 minutes to clean up. But if you want to spend 45 minutes out of your day to make that meal for your family, you can feed a family of five for less than $3 a head. There's nowhere else you can do that.
And it's high quality protein. Like, you're getting nutrients, you're getting protein, you're getting iron into kids' stomach that tastes good. Even like hamburger helper is pretty dang tasty, really, for
what. Yeah, it is. And then you get the carbs, you know, so if you're trying to balance your whole diet out, in my view, it's not a bad deal. But, you know, for people that think that hamburger shouldn't cost more than $4, with the cost of inputs at the ranch level, the dairy level, the farming level, our input costs have done nothing but gone up. And we are not going back to a $10 ribeye steak. We don't have the numbers to do it. And is beef going to become a luxury? It could, but I hope not. I hope that we can rebuild our herds. But look at the average age of the rancher out there at 64 years old or 62, whatever that number is. And the kids are not coming back to it. It's a good life, but it's a hard life. You know, when you got to get up on a February morning at 1 a.m. and it's 10 below zero, and go get a calf up because she just calved and take it to the barn and warm it up, bring it back to the cow and get them hooked back up. There's a lot of work involved. And people don't see that. All they see is the stakes in the shelf and they think they're too high. But they need to get out to the ranch and see what they're having to do there to take care of those animals to get them to the feedlot and onto your plate. It's not simple, but it's a good life, you know, if you enjoy cattle.
Oh, yeah. No, and it's a lifestyle, too. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to, if you put a dollar per hour to what you make, it's probably pennies on the dollar compared to, you know.
They're not making minimum wage.
No, because they're working, and there's no overtime. There's no, you do what you've got to do to keep those calves alive.
Yeah, when calving season hits, it's 24/7 till you're done.
And then they go out to grass, and you get a little breathing room till you bring them back in the fall.
A little. You still got to get a horse back and go ride through them and make sure everything's doing good. You know, with these temperature changes, you know, when you've got a 40-degree swing in temperatures from day to night, you know, you get calves breaking down with pneumonia because that's just too big a swing. You know, just like the weather we're going through here now. You know, doggone, it's chilly out there this morning. Need a light jacket.
Well, and it's warmer this morning than it was 2 mornings ago, too.
You know, I wasn't here 2 mornings ago, but, you know, yesterday morning and then this morning, yeah, it was, yesterday was warmer than this morning.
Yeah, in some places, Fairfield's getting snow right now, which is just insane.
Yeah, almost 1st of July.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, it's crazy.
So maybe to wrap up, if you had a crystal ball, what do you think the beef outlook looks like for the next 2, 3, 4 years?
Short. I don't think we can rebuild. So I don't know that we got any proof on it, but what we feel has happened, you had your mom and pop deals that had 10 mama cows, 20, 30, 40, 50 mama cows. They never reported those numbers to the USDA. You know, they may or may not have got the booklet in the mail to fill out. If they did, they didn't send it back in. So this whole cow liquidation started in basically 2021. We run 2020, 21, 22, 23 with huge harvests. And then all of a sudden the door starts slamming shut in 24. Now we're into 25 and it's gotten a little bit worse. The ones that I've talked to, they're running the numbers that they should run. So they don't need to so-called rebuild. They're at their numbers. So if they're at their numbers, where did all these cattle go? And that's where the little mom and pop 10Z50s come into play. Could have been as much as 60 or 70 cows and they just finally gave up. It's a lot of work to run 70 head of mama cows because you have to have an outside job to do it also. You cannot afford to make a living on 70 head of cows. Even if the ground was given to you, it's tough to do. So they're having to work basically two jobs to enjoy those cows. They're doing their outside job and then they come home and enjoy the cows. But when you got to be up and be in the office at 8 o'clock and you was up until 4 this morning, you know, helping a cow or a heifer calve, you pretty well run out. And if you don't have the, you know, the help there to do it, and you can't afford to pay somebody to help you on that smaller unit. So that's where the big ranches have a better opportunity, but they're no different than the small one. They're just 100 times bigger. You know, they're running 700 mama cows instead of 70. They still have to have the manpower to get out there and do everything that we do. So they're paying more in expenses, but they have more volume. And for the young kids that would like, they think they would like that lifestyle, the cash flow is the hardest part. You go buy the ranch, you buy the cows, and let's just say that you start out with the first calf heifer, and you bred that heifer. So you bred her in April, May to calve in February, March. Well, you'd actually breed them May, June. But anyway, February, March calf, there's a year that you have no income. You got to wait for those calves to sell in the fall of that year, November. Now you got to go back and start paying bills. So the cash flow is really hard. And to get any financing on that, you won't get it. The banks won't give it to you. The government won't give it to you. So they have to make a hard decision. How much do I want to put into this to try and see this dream come true? The little onesie, twosie, threesies out there that, you know, are leaving the big cities and going to, you know, Colorado, Idaho, wherever they're going, buying 5 or 10 acres and trying to, you know, live off the land, they can make it work with 1 or 2 cows because they can harvest a couple of those cattle a year and feed their family. And but that's not cheap in today's world either. Most of that is going to probably come out when you come back to the red meat in your freezer, you're probably going to be somewhere between minimum of $8 a pound red meat up to $10 a pound red meat. Could be $10.50. But you know that you raised that animal. So you know what you've done to it and all the way through. The rancher does the exact same thing that those families are doing. And people have to understand that. They need to get to know them. They need to trust them and watch what they do. And they're going to get the same quality, but they're going to have to lay the money out. Well, when you want to buy a carcass and put it in your freezer and it costs you $5,000 for that red meat, you know, people get that sticker shock. But if you like to eat red meat and you're going to eat quite a bit of it, start putting that back together with what you spend every week in the supermarket. And I think there's opportunities both directions.
It's painting that picture because it's like, oh yeah, I'll buy it. It's like going to Costco and buying in bulk. Like your sticker shock is like, I'm not going to pay $100 for tri-tip, but there's how many pounds in that bag.
Right.
And same thing with your whole carcasses, but it's also you're getting steaks, you're getting roasts, you're getting hamburger for that one price. So it's expensive for hamburger, but it's cheaper for steaks if you divide it down.
And the roast, there's a lady that talked about it last night. You know, they just don't take the time to, you know, to put the roast in the crock pot and let it cook all day. There's not a better meal out there. My wife makes a roast and there's leftover roast. She puts it in a baggie and I take it for my lunch. And while I'm rolling down the road, I can just put it in the console and just eat it about like jerky, you know, and there's not a better meal out there to eat on. It's all natural. Depending on what you use for seasonings, the only thing you're adding to it. It isn't very far processed other than cooking it.
And there's so many other cuts of meat you can, you know, getting a sirloin strip steak and cutting it up and making finger steaks or small steak bites to do the same thing with when you're in them.
And steak bites are great if you sear them on the outside and get the seasoning on there. Yeah, exact same thing. Just like eating jerky, it's a little wetter, but it's really good.
Yeah. Well, Rex, thanks for taking some time this morning to chat with us. Anything else you want to leave listeners with? And then why are you an ICA member?
Just the cattle industry. You know, it's been in my blood since I was a kid, raised on a small ranch farm and been in the industry, like I said, 45 to 50 years. I'd have to go back and figure it all out. 45 solid, but I just enjoy the lifestyle. I enjoy the people and they're just good, hardworking people that you want to try and help. I just want people to understand that get through the sticker shock of what the meat costs because the inflation has hit us just as bad as it hit everybody else. What I get somewhat aggravated about is that people that live in town driving their $120,000 Denali, they don't think the rancher should be able to afford the same vehicle. That's not fair. You know, and the ranchers out there working when you put in the hourly wage for a lot less money than they are. So anyway, they just need to slow down and study it and realize that what the meat costs is not as bad as what they think it is for what it's costing us to produce it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a great way to sign off. And thanks again, Rex, for swinging by today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for tuning into this week's episode of the Millennial Ag Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your friends and like, subscribe, and review to our podcast. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, or email us at talktous@millennialag.com. Until next week, we are Millennial Ag.